All right, shall we begin?
Om Sahana Vavatu. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyam Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navaditamastu Mavidvisha Vahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Good. We'll begin our recitation today. Verse 54, where Arjuna begins his question here at the end of, towards the end of chapter 2. Yep.
We're actually getting towards the end of the second chapter. We're going
at a good pace. It's good. Okay, repeat after me, please.
Arjuna Vacha. Stitta Prajnasya Ka Bhasha. Stitta Prajnasya Ka Bhasha. Samadhisthasya Keshava. Stitta Dihkim Prabhasheta. Kimasita Prajeta Kim. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Prajahati Yada Kaman. Sarvan Partha Manogatan. Atman Yevatmana Tushtaha. Stitta Prajnastadochyate. Dukeshwanudvignamanaha. Dukeshwanudvignama. Sukeshu Vigatasprahaha. Vita Raga Bhayakrodhaha. Stitta Dhir Muniruchyate. Yas Sarvatrana Bhisnehas. Tat Tat Prapya Shubhashubham. Nabhi Nandati Nadveshti. Tasya Prajna Pratishthita. Yada Samharate Chayam. Purmongani Vasarvashaha. Indriyani Indriyarthe Bhyaha. Tasya Prajna Pratishthita. Vishaya Vinivartante. Niraharasya Dehinaha. Rasa Varjam Rasopyasya. Haram Drishtva Nivartate. Yatato Hyapi Kaunteya. Purushasya Vipaschitaha. Indriyani Pramathini. Haranti Prasabham Manaha. Tani Sarvani Samyamya. Yuktaha Sita Matparaha. Vashehi Yasyendriyani. Tasya Prajna Pratishthita. Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsaha. Sangaste Shupajayate. Sangat Sanjayate Kamaha. Kamat krodho bhijayate. Krodhad bhavati sammohaha. Sammohat smriti vibhramaha. Smriti bhramshad buddhi nasho. Buddhi nashat pranashyati. Raga dvesha vimuktaistu. Vishayanindriyaischaran. Atma vashyair nividheyatma. Prasadam adhikachyati.
Very good. So let's return to where we left off from last week. Here. In our last class, we saw Arjuna's question about what is the nature of an enlightened person. And the term Arjuna uses is sthita prajna, one who is firm in wisdom. Arjuna's question arises because how can an enlightened person function on a battlefield if he's always immersed in deep meditation, in samadhi? And we joked in our last class about how we have some fairly naive or even childish ideas of what it is to be enlightened. To be enlightened is not to be 24/7 immersed in samadhi. To be enlightened is not to walk with your feet 3 inches off the ground. Some of you will remember my guru's definition, Pujaswami Dayananda, who once said, an enlightened person, remember this? An enlightened person is a normal person, the only normal person. It's a nice definition. That is, you, minus all of your problems, is an enlightened person. That's his definition. And it's perfectly consistent with what Sri Krishna here is describing to Arjuna, the nature of an enlightened person. Now, the challenge, of course, is how can you be sthita prajna? Sthita means firm, firmly established. How can you be firmly established in any perspective and in this wisdom, in this knowledge of one's true nature? How, when our senses are continually pulling us towards objects of desire? We're going to have a fascinating discussion both today and next week about desire, about how desire works, and about how to handle desire, how to overcome desire. Obviously, the sthita prajna, the enlightened person, is one who's no longer dragged about by his or her desires. We're going to discuss that having desires is normal. Can you imagine a person utterly desireless? We did this last week. Can you imagine inviting an enlightened person out to dinner, right? Remember this story? And the waiter comes with a menu and says, what do you want? And your enlightened guest tells the waiter, I don't want anything. I'm enlightened. This is silly. The enlightened person is going to say, I want, and then choose, and he'll say an item on the menu. So the enlightened person says, I want. To say I want presumes some kind of desire. So we have to talk about how is it possible an enlightened person has desire? Is it the same as an ordinary desire? Obviously not. And how is it that you might be pulled about, dragged about by desires? An enlightened person is utterly free from being dragged about from desires. The end of the last class, we talked about the difference between a binding desire and a non-binding desire. Let's pick up that thread before we continue with the next verse. It's important. What was the difference between a binding desire and a non-binding desire? A binding desire is one in whose non-fulfillment you become unhappy. A non-binding desire is a desire whose non-fulfillment is not a problem. To go back to our restaurant example, if you go to a restaurant and you say, I'll have this item, the waiter says, I'm sorry, we don't have it. What is your response? Okay, I'll have this instead. That's a non-binding desire. But we joked in our last class, if you've ever been out to, maybe we can close the door, so I'll be working on the building here. If you've ever been out to the restaurant with a difficult friend, do you have any difficult friends? You know who I'm talking about. So you go out to the restaurant with your difficult friend, and they order, I'll have this item, and the waiter says, I'm sorry, we don't have it. And your friend replies, what do you mean you don't have it? This is a binding desire. So you want the item. If you can't have it, it's okay. Your friend wants the item, and if she or he can't have it, it's a problem. This is a distinction between a non-binding desire and a binding desire. The enlightened person, listen, the enlightened person can have hundreds and thousands of desires as long as they're all non-binding, like the item on the menu. This is a goal. The goal is not to become utterly desireless. Can you imagine? Utterly desirous. Swamiji, what would you like for lunch? Nothing. Or how about this? Who cares? You know, to be utterly desireless is, we have words for it, like lethargic, or even, do you know what? It's almost like someone who's deeply depressed, right? You ask, what would you like for lunch? Oh, who cares? You get the point. The enlightened person is not utterly desireless. However, the enlightened person is utterly free of binding desires, can have thousands of desires, all of which are non-binding. With this introduction, let's pick up the thread here. Verse 58. And there's a small typo here I forgot to fix in the second line, so just repeat after me. Yada samharate chayam kurmongani vasarvashah indriyan indriyarthebhyah tasya prajna pratishthita. How to become free from binding desires? After all, our senses are always scanning around us, looking around us. Our indriyas, that word comes in this verse, our indriyas, sense organs, are always poking out into the world around us. Typically, you see something, what you want, a desire arises. So, what's commonly recommended, especially in some yogic texts, is they teach pratyahara. Pratyahara is the yogic word. Patanjali is the author of the Yoga Sutras. He used this word pratyahara to describe sense withdrawal, to remove your senses from contact with external things. And here Sri Krishna makes reference to that. By the way, it's not what you think. Because look at the example he gives. Yada, when, samharate kurmaha. Kurma. Kurma is a turtle, right? A tortoise. And you know, angan eva sarvashaha samharate. When the kurma, when a turtle, samharate, withdraws, when it withdraws angan, its limbs. You've seen a tortoise, you know, the tortoise who is frightened, the legs go in, the tail, the head, everything goes inside the shell. And the first line of this verse says, yada, just as when a... there's a small joke here. Yada samharate chayam. Somebody who doesn't understand Sanskrit properly once thought that it's when a turtle gives up drinking chai.
It's helpful to know Sanskrit a little better than that. Cha, ayam. Two words are run together. Cha and ayam are run together. Ayam kurmaha. When this turtle, a turtle, samharate, withdraws, indriyani, its limbs. Eva, just like that. Sarvashaha, from all directions. Just as a turtle withdraws its limbs from sarvashaha, from all directions, eva, just like that. In the same way, indriyani indriyarte bhyaha samharate tasya prajna pratishtata. Tasya, a person's prajna, a person's wisdom, pratishtata, supratishtata, well established. Firm. A person's wisdom is firm when indriyani indriyarte bhyaha samharate. When that person can samharate withdraw indriyani, all of his or her senses from indriyarte bhyaha, and that's the typo up there, from sense objects. Indriyani, indriya is sense organ. Indriya artha. In artha, an object of the indriya, an object of the sense, sense object. So when the wise person can withdraw his or her senses from all sense objects. Now, it's an interesting metaphor. It says, when... Just as a turtle withdraws its limbs in all directions, in the same way, a wise person is one who can withdraw their senses from all sense objects, to remain detached from all sense objects, to remain unaffected by all sense objects. All right. How? How will you do that? The turtle has the physical capacity to withdraw its limbs. How do you physically withdraw your senses? Well, one way is very obvious. Close your eyes. But we can't live our lives with our eyes closed and our ears plugged. Of course, then food will attract us, right? So we have to plug this and plug this. You want to live a life anesthetized somehow? Is that the solution? To be utterly unaffected? Then how could an enlightened person enjoy a beautiful day? How can an enlightened person enjoy looking into the eyes of an infant and feel joy? So there is a problem with interpretation here. We'll get into in the next verse. Well, let's set up the next verse. This is a favorite example, a story that I've made up, and some of you have heard it before, but it's a helpful story. Suppose someone has decided to give up chai, just as it looks like our turtle is going to give up chai, if you misunderstand the Sanskrit. Suppose you decide, oh, I'm too dependent on chai. You know, sometimes people, if you can't have it at that time, right? 7 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that chai better be ready. If it's not ready, watch out. So suppose that describes you. And you decide that you're being dragged about too much by this desire for tea. And you decide that starting, you know, based on our discussion today, an enlightened person is someone who's freed from all binding attachments and desires. You decide that you're going to become free from this binding desire for chai. How will you do that? You decide that starting tomorrow morning, no more chai. But so, tomorrow morning you get up, and at 7 o'clock, you have your usual, your first cup of chai. Nope, not today. 9 or 10 o'clock comes, your second cup, nothing. 4 p.m. comes, your afternoon chai, nothing. The whole day comes and goes, and not one drop of chai.
has touched your lips. Have you given up the desire for drinking tea? Tell me, if this is you, what have you been thinking about all day long? Right? You can't think about anything else. You're at your computer at work thinking, oh, if only I had a cup of tea. This is the problem. You can give up chai. You cannot give up your desire for chai. Let's see how we deal with this issue, and we'll get into that in the next verse. Vishaya vinivartante. Niraharasya dehinaha. Rasavarjam prasopyasya. Haram drishtvani vartate. Vishayaha vinivartante niraharasya dehinaha. Niraharasya dehinaha. For a dehi, for a person, a living person, a person with a body. For that person who is niraharasya, who has given up something. Who has given up, in our example, who has given up chai. But a person who has given up anything, a person who has given up an object to which he or she is attached, an object for which there's a binding desire. So for a person who has, well, shall we use the big word that's used in Vedanta, renunciation. For a person who has renounced some particular object, for a person who has renounced drinking chai. For that person, vishayaha vinivartante. Vishaya, the object, the things that they've given up, vinivartante, have completely gone away. When you have a lot of willpower, excellent. So you use that will and you completely renounce whatever it is. So in that way, vishayaha, those objects that you have given up, that you have renounced, vinivartante, they completely go away from you. Rasa varjam, except for the rasa. The rasa does not go away. Varjam here means except for. Rasa varjam. Rasa means taste. This ruchi, that's why chai is such a good example. Because you just get in the mood for drinking that cup of chai. That mood remains and could conceivably remain day after day after day if you stop drinking chai. So, through an act of will, you can give up the vishaya, the object. Through an act of will, can you give up the rasa, the ruchi, the desire, the like, the taste? Not through an act of will. So then how are we going to come out of all the desires? This is really a dilemma. We have hundreds and thousands of desires. There's a rasa, there's a ruchi, there's a thirst for each and every one of these things. And as long as we're thirsting after them, then we're stuck with the binding desires. And as long as we have binding desires, how can we speak of enlightenment? How can we speak of true freedom, inner freedom? So, how then can we come out of desires? How can we convert binding desires into non-binding desires? The answer is found in the end of the verse, param drishtva. Nivartate. That is, that the rasa, that ruchi, that taste, that desire, that thirst, the binding nature of the desire goes away, vinivartante, goes away when, nivartante, goes away when, param drishtva, having discovered the ultimate. What does that mean? It's very brief, very cryptic, so let's spend a few minutes examining this. In fact, favorite line of inquiry is to find out, how do we get rid of desires? Shall we do this together? Let's figure out how do we get desires in the first place, and then how do we get rid of them? Desire or we used the term attachment in prior classes, attachment, sangha or asakti. Sangha or asakti mean attachment. And we define these words so carefully before. Do you remember the definition? We said that attachment is when your contentment depends on somebody or something. That's attachment. That's a binding desire. If back in the restaurant, your friend's contentment depended on getting that particular item from the menu, your contentment did not depend on getting that particular item from the menu. Therefore, your difficult friend has a binding desire. You have a non-binding desire. How do these binding desires arrive? They're binding desires because of attachment. And what is attachment? To look upon that object as necessary for your contentment. Pretty fundamental. To be content, to be at peace, is the fundamental desire of all people. Sometimes it's said very casually, everyone seeks happiness. I'm not sure, happiness maybe is not an adequate word. But to say that everyone seeks inner peace, everyone seeks that kind of contentment. This is a universal truth of our experience. We all have exactly the same experience here. We all seek that inner peace and contentment. Whatever you look upon as necessary for that inner peace and contentment, that is a binding desire, that is attachment, asakti. So, to have a desire means to look upon something as a source of happiness. Can we put it in those terms? In very loose terms. To look upon something as a source of contentment, inner peace, or we'll simply say to look upon it as a source of happiness. And it would be fun to remember back to your childhood days and remember a particular toy or plaything that you were very attached to, like a doll or some toy that your mother couldn't take out of your hands hardly. You held on to it tightly. Some toy or plaything to which you were very attached. Why were you so attached to that plaything? It made you happy. This is a source of happiness for you, so you clung to it like everything. Now, that was a binding desire. Do you have that same binding desire today for that plaything, for that doll? I hope not. So, now, think back to your childhood days. How did you give up that binding attachment for that doll or plaything? Did you one day say, I'm a big boy now, I'm a big girl now, so I'm going to renounce this plaything? I bet it didn't happen quite like that. Because children don't really have the spirit of renunciation very much. So what did happen to you is the question. What was it that allowed you to give up that toy or plaything? What made you give up that desire? And if you remember back, the answer is you found a better toy, right? That is, whatever you thought was so wonderful, you found something better. And when you found something better, you gave this one up. Now, of course, whatever you found is better, you looked upon that as a source of happiness. So you give up one toy, one source of happiness, and go for another toy, a better source of happiness than that toy you were very attached to until you found a better toy. And then that toy you hold on to dearly because it is now the source of happiness until you find a better toy. And I think we talked about this several classes ago. We spend our lives looking for better and better toys, and that continues in adulthood. It continues in the form of a new car, a new home, a new job, a new vacation, whatever. And sadly, and especially in, pardon me for saying this, but especially in this country, you know, new car, new house. Can you see where this is going? New car, new house, new spouse. This is a problem, a huge problem. And isn't it all based on the same quest for inner peace, inner contentment, going for a better and better toy or plaything? When does it end? This is a challenge. As long as you're in that mode of seeking better and better toys, there's no end. You know, when will you get the best toy? All of your other desires will be satisfied. Remember the Laddu joke from the Laddu story from the last class. I won't tell you the whole story again, but in one Upanishad, there's a remarkable statement where the teacher says, there is one thing gaining, no, the student asks, I want that one thing gaining which all other desires will be satisfied. This is the question. The student says, and I have to go find a reference for you. The student says, O Guru, please give me that one thing that when I have it, all my other desires will absolutely be fulfilled. This is the key. Well, what would be that one thing possessing which all other binding desires, all binding desires would fall away? Now, here's our typical Vedantic analysis. As a child, you hold on to that toy because you think the toy is a source of happiness. Is a toy a source of happiness? We went through this. You'll have to remind me. Did we go through this in a previous class where we talked? Remember the ice cream story? Did I tell that in this Bhagavad Gita class? The ice cream story, if you don't remember, is I asked a group of kids, what is the source of happiness? One kid said, ice cream. Did I tell you that here? I'm seeing a lot of non-recognition, so let me tell the story briefly. So I asked the kids, what is the source of happiness? One kid says, ice cream, chocolate ice cream, his favorite. So I ask him, if you go to the store and have one scoop of ice cream, will that make you happy? Yes. If you go to the store and have two scoops of ice cream, how will that be? The boy says, I will be twice as happy. You go to the store and have three scoops of ice cream, the boy says, I will be three times as happy. Leading to my next question, suppose you come home with one of those 5-gallon containers of ice cream, and you eat all 5 gallons in one sitting, how will that be? Honest to God, this boy said, that would be awesome! Honestly, it happened just like that. Swamiji, that would be totally awesome. Now, of course, the boy would be totally sick after eating all that ice cream. If ice cream is the source of happiness, it should be mathematical, should it not? Three scoops should be three times as happy. A 5 gallons should make you ecstatic. Makes you sick. It doesn't take a lot of insight to recognize that happiness doesn't come from the ice cream. Happiness is not an ingredient in the ice cream. Is happiness an ingredient? When you look at a carton of ice cream, it has the ingredients there. What are the ingredients in ice cream? Milk. Good. Then what? Sugar. Right? Then what? Corn syrup, which is sugar. Then what? Fructose, which is sugar. Then what? You get the idea. Basically, ice cream is milk and sugar and some chemicals and stuff put in there. Happiness is not one of the ingredients. So how shall we explain, when you eat the ice cream, you become happy? Happiness is not coming from the ice cream. Then where does that happiness come from? Even a child can get it, You knew this long ago. You know, you're mature enough, everyone knows that the true source of happiness is within. But sometimes that statement, the true source of happiness lies within, it sits in our heads like one of these sound bites. That is a phrase that you know is true, but you don't think about it, you don't examine it, you don't reflect on the consequences of that truth. It's a little bit like, suppose we could get a tota, a parrot, and teach this parrot to say, happiness lies within, happiness lies within, happiness lies within. And then you put some sunflower seeds out. What is this parrot going to do? He's going to go for those seeds, saying all the time, happiness lies within, happiness lies within. Do you think we might be a little bit like that parrot? Saying the words, happiness lies within, but going and finding a new restaurant to check out. You know happiness lies within, but you're looking for that really cool new restaurant. You know happiness lies within, but when you get in your new car, I've given this example before. This is a very striking one. Think of when the first time you get in that new car. Tell me honestly, doesn't that car feel like a source of happiness? It does. It wears off. I know that feeling wears off. But the first time you get in that new car, it really feels so good. It feels like a source of happiness. So here, the parrot is saying, the true source of happiness is within. Happiness lies within. But how do you feel behind the wheel of your new car? How do you feel the day you move into your new home? How do you feel the day that you start your new job? You feel. And that's normal. But what that shows is a gap, a disconnect in our heads between this half understanding that happiness lies within, but our habitual pursuit of objects of pleasure outside. How are we going to really come out of this? And now we're ready to come back to the verse and finish this up. Suppose, using these Vedantic teachings we find in the Bhagavad Gita, supported by prayer, supported by meditation, supported by a life of karma yoga, a life of spiritual practice, suppose you are led to finally discover the true source of happiness. Now, notice when a parrot says happiness lies within, has a parrot actually discovered that happiness lies within? No. The parrot has just been taught to say happiness lies within. Now tell me, when you say happiness lies within, have you personally discovered that aspect of your being which is truly the source of contentment and peace? Perhaps you have. Perhaps you have yet to make that discovery. For example, if you can sit in quiet meditation or contemplation and just feel perfectly content, perfectly fulfilled, absolutely at peace, then you've discovered. This is the discovery. Just to reflect on this, if you can sit on a chair with nothing to do for several hours, can imagine sitting on a chair for several hours, no newspaper, no radio, no music, no magazine, no book, no computer, no internet, no cell phone, no whatever, nothing. Just you and the chair. Can you sit there and be content? If you can, you've discovered something very... And by the way, and be awake.
If you sleep off, that doesn't count. Isn't it significant that most people sitting alone become uncomfortable? Just a bit of an aside, but it's an important aside. Isn't it interesting that most people would look for some kind of distraction? You become bored or uncomfortable. Some of you remember this. This is one of the most brilliant stories that Pooja Swami Dayananda tells. And allow me to share it with you, because it's brilliant. And some of you have heard this story before. When he was coming to this country for the first time, 1976, and he phones up an airline to get some information. He's on the phone, and they put him on hold, and they play some music while he's on hold. Now, in 1976, that was kind of a new thing. Coming from India, he had never heard music on hold, and he turned to his host and says, "Why are they putting music on the phone?" And his host replied, "Oh, Swamiji, they do that so you won't get bored." And he said, "Bored with whom?" Isn't that interesting that when you're on the phone, on hold, they're so concerned that you're going to get bored. In whose company are you? Are you that bad company that you get... But isn't that the fact of the matter, is that you do get bored, you do get uncomfortable. Bored with whom? Uncomfortable with whom? This suggests that the discovery of the true source of contentment and peace within, that discovery has not truly been made yet. The words are there, like the parrot. Happiness lies within, happiness lies within. But words are not enough. Knowing the concept or the idea that happiness lies within is not enough. What is enough is your personal discovery of that truth, of that already existent truth, of the source of happiness within. To make that discovery is a remarkable discovery. This is atmajnanam. This is self-knowledge. This is the discovery of your true nature, divine nature, satchidananda atma. In Vedanta, we have a whole technical vocabulary that we use to describe this. This is to discover that aspect of you which is already full, always complete, never suffering, utterly unaffected by any problem or pain or difficulty. To make this discovery is an extraordinary event, and that's exactly the extraordinary event that Sri Krishna points to here as the solution to the problem of suffering. He says, param drishtva. Drishtva, having seen, literally, but it means having discovered. Having discovered what? Param, the ultimate, the absolute. And in our context, the truth of yourself, that which is full and complete, that which is divine. So, param drishtva nivartate, having discovered the true source of happiness, all desires are simultaneously converted into non-binding desires. Listen to that once more. When you discover the true source of happiness within, all of those hundreds and thousands of binding desires that yank you around today, that pull you around like that pull for chai, all of those binding desires will simultaneously and effortlessly be converted into non-binding desires when you discover the true source of contentment within. Because with that discovery, you'll know that even without the chai, you're absolutely okay. Who cares? It's just chai. Who cares? It's just chai. Who cares? It's just a new car. Who cares? It's just a new house.
who cares? It's just a new job. If I can have it, fine. If I can't have it, it's okay. If I can have the new house, that'll be nice. If I can't have the new house, that's fine. If I can have the new car, excellent. If I can't have the new car, okay. This is inner freedom. But this only comes, it comes, just to summarize this and then we'll go on. Does it come through renunciation of objects of desire? No. Because previous verse said, you get rid of the desire, rasavarjam, you get rid of the objects, this verse. You get rid of the vishaya, you do not get rid of the rasa. You get rid of the object, you don't get rid of the desire or thirst for that object through renunciation, through an act of will. But with the help of these teachings, you can discover the true source of contentment within. Satchidananda Atma, the full, complete, perfect, true self, the inner divinity. With that discovery, all desires go away. All desires go away means what? Do you become lethargic? No. Means all desires are converted into non-binding desires. You want them. And before we move on, there's a common argument that's made here.
I don't think it's...
Okay. So let's take this separate. A common argument that is sometimes made here is that, these lofty Vedantic teachings could be harmful to you in an earlier stage of life, especially if you're a grihastha. But these teachings are certainly appropriate in the end of your life when you're old and retired and all of that. Have you ever heard anything like this before?
Yes.
This is partially due to a bad misunderstanding of this very topic. The argument goes that if you really come up spiritually, if you gain this kind of spiritual wisdom, that you will lose all your desires. And if you lose all your desires, how will you progress in life? So suppose you have a family and a profession. If you lose your desire for your profession, how will you continue to grow in your profession so that you can take care of your family better? And of course, if you're at a point when the kids are getting ready to go to college, you look at what the college fees are in most in some of these schools is mind-boggling. How are you going to? And let's just take this up as an example. If you lose your desire, if you lose your drive for your profession, if you become kind of complacent at your profession, how are you possibly going to provide for your family, for the children who have college fees, all of these things? So therefore, what should you do? You better work hard and stay away from this Vedanta stuff until you're old and... All right. Most of you have already figured out the misunderstanding, but let's make it very, very clear. I'll pose a question to you. We said that an enlightened person can have hundreds and thousands of desires, but they're all non-binding desires. Now, question to you. Can you be motivated to vigorously pursue a non-binding desire? Think about it for a moment. How would you answer that question? Can you be vigorously motivated to pursue a non-binding desire? The answer is, why not? Why not? What would prevent you, if you're enlightened and you have a profession, what would prevent you from climbing the ladder? Why not? Climb the ladder. It's the right thing to do. That way you can provide for your family better. Besides, it's just more fun. And can I share with you, and this is a story that I don't think I've used here for a long time, It's a favorite story. Some of you have heard it before, but I keep apologizing when I retell stories because I don't know. I just don't like to tell the same stories over and over again. But some stories are irreplaceable. This poker game story I find irreplaceable. So allow me to share with you a favorite story. It's actually an anecdote about a poker game. When I was a college student, studying in an engineering school in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the 1970s, our usual Friday night thing as students was to get together for a poker game. Poker was a game of choice, and we'd get together in somebody's apartment and play poker for several hours. This being Milwaukee, there's something else that we did during these poker games. Milwaukee, of course, is known for beer, and we, true to our city, we drank a lot of beer. This is what we did every Friday night. We got together, we played a lot of poker, we drank a lot of beer. This went on for many, many months. Now, poker is a game of strategy and betting. You really have to bet. Otherwise, it's not fun. You have to make a wager. That's where the fun comes. And when we started playing these poker games, we'd bet, play for nickels and dimes and quarters and just small change, pocket change. And by doing that, we would have a great time. We'd play the whole night. And at the end of the night, you might win a couple of dollars. You might lose a couple of dollars. It's not a big deal. So it was just betting some small change just to make it fun. Drink a lot of beer, play a lot of poker, and go home. Even if you have a bad night of poker, you only lose $2 or $3, so it's not a big deal. What happened, however, and this is a true story, what happened is over a period of months, the stakes slowly crept up. Just like inflation, everything just very slowly, subtly. So early on, if we were playing for nickels and dimes and quarters, then it became 25 cents, 50 cents, 75 cents. And then dollar bills began to appear on the table more and more frequently. Then $5 bills began to appear on the table. Then $10 bills began to appear on the table. And occasionally $20 bills began to be seen on that table. The stakes went up to such a point where if you had a bad night, you could lose $20, $30, $40, $50. And we were poor college students. $50 was a lot of money to a poor in the 1970s. $50 was a lot of money to a poor college student. I actually dropped out of the games. It was too rich for me, as they say. Before I dropped out, I observed something, though. When the stakes were low, I had such a great time. As the stakes went up, two things happened. One is I enjoyed it less. The other thing that happened as the stakes went up is I drank much less beer. Because you drink several beers, you get fuzzy. There's a lot of strategy involved in this game. And if your head is fuzzy and you've got a lot of money there, you can't afford that. So, this is a story. Isn't it kind of fun to hear a Swami telling you a story about... But this is what it was in those days. All right. Now, there's some very, very important observations to be made based on this story. Notice, as the stakes went up, I drank less beer and I enjoyed it more. When the stakes were low, I could drink to my heart's content and I had a lot more fun. This is a metaphor for life. Usually, life appears like a high stakes poker game. High stakes because you can't afford to lose. That's how I felt. I couldn't afford. That was my gasoline money for the week was on the table. if I lose that money, how am I going to afford gasoline for my car? This was the reality of the situation. I couldn't afford to lose, and that's what made the game so miserable for me. Can you afford to lose? If you can afford to lose everything, then you can enjoy everything. If you can afford, let's get real now. If you can afford to lose your car, and sometimes a car gets stolen or damaged in an accident, okay. So the car is stolen. So? Car is stolen. I don't have insurance. Okay, you do what you can. Buy some cheap car, whatever. But can you be okay? Can you tolerate the loss of a car? In theory, yes. I mean, this is the goal. The goal is to come to a point where you can afford to, listen, the goal is to come to go through a process of spiritual growth, of inner growth, to the point where you can afford to lose your car, you can afford to lose your house, you can afford to lose your job, you can even, in the long term, afford to lose your health and even your physical body. How is that possible? Param drishtva. Only when you make this ultimate discovery that it's okay, because none of this really counts, none of this really matters, because your true nature is full and complete, Satchidananda, after all. With this discovery, life becomes like the low-stakes poker game. With me so far? And think, what a joy it would be. Now here's the real reason for introducing this story is this. This story is the best I've discovered for making the point that when the stakes are low, you still strive. The leading question was this. If you had only non-binding desires, would you be highly motivated to pursue those non-binding desires? If you were enlightened in a big corporation, would you work hard at climbing that corporate ladder, or would you take this very lax attitude, who cares? Now, I would suggest that if you truly were enlightened, you would be climbing that corporate ladder just like anyone else, just like you did before you were enlightened. Why? Go back to the poker game story. When the stakes were high, remember there's a lot of strategy in poker. So when the stakes were high, I would look at my cards and very carefully figure out what was the best card to make, what was the best bet to make, what was the right strategy to employ. Quite a bit of strategy. And I did that because what was motivating me to play well? When the stakes were high, what was motivating me? The word is fear. Right? That was my gas money on the table. I had to win something back, or I'd have to walk to school or take the bus or something. So I was motivated by fear. Now watch. When the stakes were low, do you think I was playing casually? When the stakes were low, you just throw out any card? No. When the stakes were low, I would think just as hard. I would use the same clever strategy. I would play just as vigorously if the stakes are high or the stakes are low, right? Anyone would. But look at the difference. When the stakes are high, I was motivated by fear. When the stakes were low, I was motivated by fun. It's fun. You do the best you can because it's fun. What a model of life. Generally, the stakes are high. We're motivated by fear. That's a fact. You can't afford to lose. But if the stakes are low, you're still highly motivated. You're getting this now. If the stakes are low, you're still motivated, just as motivated. Only difference is you're motivated by a sense of enjoyment,
a sense of enjoying the wonderful gifts and opportunities that you've been blessed with in this life, but there's no loss of motivation. I would even argue that you're more effective if you look upon life as a low-stakes game. Watch. The usual counter-argument is you won't take life too seriously, you won't try hard enough. Nonsense. I would argue that if you take life too seriously, if you think the stakes are too high, you will have sufficient fear and anxiety that the fear and anxiety will cause you to make mistakes. When we experience significant fear and anxiety in life, we don't always do our best. Can you imagine me in a moment of desperation? I'm really losing badly and all my money is out there and I don't know what to do and I'm very frustrated, I'm angry, I'm afraid, I'm anxious, and my head is so full of tension, I make a mistake in playing because of all the tension. I would argue that I would play better strategy looking upon it as low stakes. The argument applies to life. If you see life as low stakes, first you're going to be just as motivated as you were before. Previously you were motivated by fear, now you'll be motivated by a sense of joy, but you will be equally motivated, and more than that, I think you'll be more effective in your life because you won't be so troubled by fear and anxiety. You'll be more effective at accomplishing whatever you want. So let's be clear about what's being taught here. The word that's commonly used here is vairagya. Vairagya means dispassion. And the word vairagya has got a bad rap, so to speak. That is, people look upon it as devaluing the world, withdrawal from the world, kind of renunciation of worldly thinking, of worldly stuff. This is a poor interpretation of what vairagya is. Here we have two verses on vairagya. Vairagya, dispassion. How does this dispassion take place? Param drishtva. Having discovered the true source of contentment and peace within, life becomes like that low stakes poker game. Good. Let's continue. Good. We'll sneak in two more verses here today.
Yatato hyapi kaunteya purushasya vipaschitaha indriyani pramathini haranti prasabham manaha.
Talking about the problem, the challenge that one encounters, it says, purushasya, for a person, vipaschitaha, who's reasonably wise, purushasya vipaschitaha, for a reasonably wise person, Kaunteya, O son of Kunti, O Arjuna, yatataha api, even though that person strives, for a reasonably wise person, yatataha api, even though that person is striving, even then, indriyani pramatini, even then, your indriyas, your senses, pramatini, can be stirred up. Indriyani pramatini, even then, your senses can be stirred up, haranti, and can rob away manaha, your mind, prasabham, forcefully. Now, senses are easily stirred up. You know, just a silly example. Somebody says, oh, we went to this really nice restaurant last night. And your response is, oh, what is that restaurant? And what is... and, you know, here it comes. Somebody says, we had this really nice meal, and what happens to your indriyas?
pramatana, meaning you get stirred up a little bit, you get interested. And please, this isn't a criticism, they're just a good example. So you're thinking, huh, what, maybe, and then, oh, it's turned, suppose you had a commitment to do something else tonight. You were supposed to go someplace, do something. You're supposed to do some volunteer work at your local public library. I'm just making something up. So tonight you were supposed to do some volunteer work at your local public library, but you just heard about this really cool restaurant, and you're thinking that would be awfully nice, and that evening you decide, well, if I don't go into the library, they won't miss me much. So you end up not doing the volunteer work that you had committed to do, and instead go to the restaurant. This is a fairly realistic example, and it illustrates exactly what's described in the last part of this verse, and that is the indriyas, your senses, pramatini, are very easily stirred up or diverted. And when this ruchi, when this taste, when this thirst or desire arises, very easily your manas, your mind, can be haranti, can be taken away, prasabham, forcefully. And he says, yatataha api, vipashyataha api, even though vipashyat means wise. You're wise. You know the true source of happiness lies within. That's a kind of wisdom, but again, it's a little bit like the parrot's wisdom, and that is, you know the concept, you know the idea, you know the principle, but you have yet to fully discover for yourself. So even though you are vipashyat, even though you know, you've studied Bhagavad Gita, and you've done all of this, so you have this kind of wisdom, but and you are yatataha, you are continuing to strive, as you are today. You made the time this morning to come to the ashram for this class. So this verse is talking about all of you. You are vipashyat, you have some wisdom, you have some understanding. This verse says you are yatata, you are making further effort, as you are this morning. And it says, even then, indriyani pramatini, even then, your senses can lead you away. Why? They're very strong. Prasabham, forcefully, haranti, they rob away, manaha, your mind. So what to do? Tani sarvani samyamya.
Tani sarvani samyamya.
Yuktaha sita matparaha.
Yuktaha sita matparaha.
Vashehi yasyendriyani.
Vashehi yasyendriyani.
Tasya prajna pratishtita. Tani sarvani, tani, those, sarvani, all those, referring to what? Indriyani in the prior verses. All those senses. For the restaurant, it's this one, right? Somebody says, oh, we went to this really nice restaurant last night. So you're hearing something desirable. Sometimes we smell something desirable. We taste something desirable. We see something desirable. We touch something desirable. So our senses bring us into contact with objects and things that we wrongly conclude are the source of contentment and inner peace, and that's why they drag us around. So this verse, talking about the solution, tani sarvani, all of those senses, what should you do? Samyamya, having controlled, having restrained. Samyamya, having restrained all of those senses. Now we're a little bit back to the turtle problem, right? The tortoise withdraws its limbs. So when Sri Krishna says to withdraw your senses. The previous verse made it clear that he's not talking about being like a turtle. He used a turtle example, but you all know that examples have to be properly interpreted. A drishtanta. Drishtanta means example. Every drishtanta lends itself to misinterpretation. So let us interpret the drishtanta properly. A turtle withdraws its limbs. How do you withdraw from sense objects? How do you give up sense objects? How do you renounce, so to speak, these attachments and binding desires? Previous verse said param drishtva, having discovered the ultimate, having discovered the true source of contentment within. This verse says almost the same thing, slightly different words. Samyamya, having controlled all your senses. How? Being yuktaha, being... Yukta is a word that defies proper translation in English. Yuj is the dhatu. Yuj, the same dhatu, the same verbal root, by the way, from which yoga is derived. So yoga and yukta come from the same root. The root means, mostly it means to control. So here, yukta, the best meaning perhaps, would be one who is controlled. But controlled not through mere willpower. Remember, we're talking about yoga, we're talking about spiritual practice here. We're not talking about mere willpower. Willpower has its role, but it only goes so far. We joked about the chai. You can give up drinking tea using your will. You cannot give up the desire, the thirst, the ruchi, the enjoyment of tea. You cannot give up through the power of will. So here, yukta here means being controlled, being self-controlled, but not through will. How can you be controlled but not through will? Means if you're immune to things that would pull you in other directions. Generally, we think that somebody who's in control is someone who's strong enough and he's just going to push on in one direction and use the will just to drive on and drive on. There's another mode of thinking in life, the mode of the enlightened person, which is not based so much on will, but based on the absence of diversions, absence of being pulled in wrong directions. If you observe that an enlightened person or a spiritually mature person lives a good life, lives a saintly life, or lives a life free from worldly problems, is it that they're using their will to do that? From the example I gave, you can presume that I stopped drinking beer and playing poker decades ago. In fact, poker ended with that game, and I think beer drinking maybe persisted for a few more years, and then that went away. Later, meat eating went away. Later, yet other things went away. More things went away. Eventually, profession went away. A beautiful home went away. And sometimes people will ask, Swamiji, how could you give all that stuff up? You had a beautiful home in California, overlooking the Pacific Ocean, this kind of paradise-like situation, the good job, the comfortable California lifestyle. And then people say, Swamiji, how could you give all that up? And I've only have one very simple answer for it, and that is, I'm not very good at giving things up. Are you good at giving things up? Most of us aren't. And I'll admit, I'm not good at giving things up. If you ask me to give up drinking chai, I'll say, okay. You ask me to give up drinking coffee, I'll say, no way. So, I am not good at giving things up. Then, how is it that this beautiful home and profession and California lifestyle, how did I give all that up? And the answer is, I didn't. I never gave it up. I never once in my spiritual journey, I never once had the sense of giving anything up. It's always a sense of going towards that which is desirable. Big difference. Vairagya is not running away from that which is undesirable. Vairagya is having a value for that which is of ultimate importance in life. Spiritual growth, discovering the God of the cosmos present in your own heart and mind. This is the goal. And somebody who's like me just ends up pursuing that goal so intensely, other things go away. This has happened to you in other aspects of life where you've pursued something so intensely. Think maybe in your college days, some of you were very intensely engaged in the process of learning, and I bet there were times when you did nothing else. You didn't hang out with your friends, you didn't go to movies, possibly, if you were in a period where you were extremely engaged in things. Or a very common example, most of you haven't come from India, think of your first several years in this country, how intensely focused you were on getting established here, and how many other things just go away naturally. So the point is, when you're really focused on a particular goal, other things go away. This is what it means here to be yukta, controlled. Not through will, but by virtue of your value system, by virtue of your worldview, by virtue of what you find valuable. Whatever you find valuable, you pursue. So this person who, tani sarvani, all those senses, samyamya, having withdrawn them completely, being yukta, being self-controlled. And how does all this come about? Previous verse said, param drishtva, having discovered God's presence within, to paraphrase that. This verse says almost the same thing, asita matparaha, asita, remaining how? Matparaha, focused on me. Sri Krishna speaks here in the first person. Mat is a pronoun form here. Matpara. Asita matpara, remaining focused on me. The implication is not Sri Krishna in the chariot. The implication is Sri Krishna in your own heart. So being focused on that inner divinity as a true source of contentment and peace. That person, vashehi yasya indriyani, yasya, for that person, he, when, indriyani, when the senses, vashe, are all controlled, so for such a person, when all the senses are controlled, vasha, vashe, when they're controlled, and again, how are they controlled? Not through will. They're controlled with this transformation of our understanding. It's an inner transformation, a transformation of values, a transformation of your worldview, where a world which was once seen as a high-stakes poker game becomes like a low-stakes poker game. When that transformation has taken place, then what? Tasya, for that person, prajna, true wisdom, pratishtita, is absolutely well established. So this is the goal of a life of spiritual growth, is to transform all binding desires into non-binding desires, or as the story suggested, to be able truly to look upon life as a low-stakes poker game in which you're highly engaged, fully motivated to do as much as you can, but instead of being motivated by fear, you can be motivated by a sense of delight and joy and gratitude for all the opportunities we've been given. Good. We will continue this discussion in our next class. I have several important announcements. If I can ask you to remain seated